This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
The whole Buddhist teaching path is about freedom. This term freedom, I think it's interesting. Interesting, just look at what does your mind do with the term freedom? What does that mean to you? What kind of connotations does your mind have with freedom? What's it mean to be free? There's two ways that my mind does with it. There's the freedom to do whatever the fuck I want. That kind of the freedom to, and then there's the freedom from. And of course, Buddhism's much more interested in freedom from suffering and the causes of suffering than the freedom to just do whatever we want. I think we each have to really be brutally honest with ourselves. Like how much do I want to be free from suffering? To what? How hard am I willing to work for that? How much? How invested am I? And part of the conversation is how much do I even think it's possible? How much confidence or faith or do you even believe that you can stop suffering? That you could actually be free? You could actually, we could use the term happy. I don't mind the term happiness. I know some people don't like it. Freedom from suffering, we could say equals like a sense of happiness. But happiness from this perspective doesn't mean what we tend to make it mean, which is that it's pleasant all of the time and that you're kind of getting what you want and happiness that's much closer to contentment, more like a sense of peace and well-being with what is, that kind of happiness, not the kind of happiness where it's like everything's going great. The kind of happiness of like everything's fucked, but I'm okay. Everything's really difficult in this moment, and there's pain, and there's loss, and there's systematic racist oppression. And I'm okay in this moment. It's not all good. It's not all good. I'm not happy because it's all good. I'm happy because I have an ability to be at ease with how terrible it is at times. That kind of happiness, that kind of freedom. And there's levels of this freedom. There's, it's not so kind of all or none. Like, am I completely free, or am I feel like there's a experience of progress that happens as we train our minds, as we bring more mindfulness, we start to understand impermanence, we start to cling less. There's less suffering, more freedom. We start to have more compassion. There's less suffering, more freedom from suffering in the midst of pain. And so there is definitely a continuum of this freedom, and we can kind of look at where we are on the path and the progress that we've made. Some of you may be brand new in the midst of whatever you're in the midst of, brand new to practice or to, and it feels like, oh, I have very little freedom. I know when I started my practice, I was like, yeah, I'm way over here in like zero happiness and zero freedom and lots of suffering. And then practicing and kind of felt like, oh, that freedom is coming very slowly. This is a real gradual path. And then there's the absolute freedom that Buddhism actually promises. Nirvana, freedom from suffering. Where you can be completely and totally free from suffering. And the Buddha talked about, I've reached nirvana. I no longer cling to any sense pleasures. I still enjoy sense pleasures occasionally, but I don't suffer about them. I don't cling to them. I no longer meet pain with hatred. And he talked about the pain that he lived with, physical pain, also unpleasant mind states that came. He called it Mara. He said, Mara attacks me. He said, but I don't suffer about it. I'm free from taking the mind personal. I'm free from meeting pain with hatred. And then this is the ultimate goal of Buddhism, is like, can I actually get free with my pain? Not freedom from pain. Freedom from suffering about the inevitable pains of having a physical body and a mind. Inevitable unpleasantness in this form. It's not that you're doing it all wrong. It just sucks to have a mind and a body sometimes. Even the fully enlightened one said, and I quote, this sucks. It's unpleasant to have a human mind. And, you know, of course, a lot of Buddhists want to say, like, oh, no, enlightenment perfects the mind. It's totally, it's joy, it's bliss. It's not according to the early Buddhist teachings. He said there's zero suffering, but there's still plenty of pain. Towards the end of his life, he was dealing with aging, and his body was, he had some chronic pain that he had to live with. He said, the only time that I am not in pain is when I'm in the jhanas, when I'm in the deeply concentrated meditation state. If I'm not in that deeply concentrated meditation state, I am feeling unpleasant sensations in my body. He had a bad back. His foot had been smashed in a murder attempt on his life. And I tell these stories partially just to like give us a realistic expectation of what kind of freedom we're looking for. Still, it's a very high bar, this freedom. But it's not the delusion that so many of us have and that I still see in my own mind of like, well, I shouldn't be in pain. I should be so spiritual that all the pain goes away. Or that the mind stops being judgmental or comparing or inflated or deflated or whatever the ego is doing today. The Buddhist view really is not about perfecting it, but changing our relationship to it. This is what the Buddha did. He got freedom from taking it personal. The not-self, the anatta teachings. Not a perfect mind, it's just I don't take it personal anymore. I know that that's not who I am, that the mind has a mind of its own. There's some survival instinct here and that we call the ego, this I, me, mine. It's not your fault. But we do have a choice if we're willing to work for it. This is what meditation is doing for us. If we're willing to work hard, we have the ability to have a radical transformation of our relationship to pleasure, our relationship to pain, our relationship to the self, to the mind, and to experience freedom from the causes of suffering. Not freedom from pain, not avoidance of pleasure, not a lobotomy of the mind, this kind of view that people hold around spiritual practice is like, your mind's going to be quiet all the time. Zero afflictive emotions. That's not enlightenment. That is delusion. So freedom and one of the first things after the Buddha came to his awakening, he reflected on, he said, how did I get here? He said, I've been looking for this experience. He said, I got here and I know that it's here and I know that I now have the ability to meet all of the pain with compassion. I learned how to do that. I trained my mind by turning towards my pain rather than running from it. I've trained my heart and my mind to be compassionate towards pain. I'll no longer suffer about pain. I'll now meet pain with compassion. It means that I understand impermanence so clearly. I'll no longer cling to pleasure. I'll no longer get attached, even though this is right after he says, I came to this experience that was against the stream, that clinging and aversion and self-centeredness are normal. He said, but I've now broken out of the norm. And I've come to this experience where I understand nothing is worth clinging to. Nothing is worth suffering about. And I'm not going to suffer anymore. And I'm not going to take this mind personal. I have discernment now of what thoughts are wise and what thoughts are unwise. And when he reflected, he said, oh shit, I got here. I've been, you know how that is when you have been on a journey and it's so much about like being on the journey and then you get there. And you're like, now what? I'm here. This was all about the trip. And I was on the trip and I was going there. I was so excited about getting there. And then you get there. It feels like he had that experience where he's like, I just want to not suffer. And he's like, okay, now I'm not suffering. I'm done. I'm free. And then he said, oh, how did I get here? I did all of this meditation and renunciation. And he said, the first thing is that I just believed it was possible. For some reason, I had a knowing, a faith, a confidence that we didn't have to live like this. That there had to be a different way to relate to the human condition, to our own minds, to our own emotions, to our own sensations. There had to be a way that wasn't filled with so much suffering and dissatisfaction and self-centeredness. Said, I just believed that that was possible, even though nobody I asked could tell me how to do it. And everyone that I asked gave me bad advice. They said, oh, just ignore your mind forever. Concentrate it away. They said, oh, pleasure, you're attached to pleasure. Avoid all pleasure forever. Pleasure's the problem. You got craving? Go live naked in the forest. No more pleasure for you. He said, I got a bunch of bad advice of, teachings from supposedly enlightened gurus that did not work. They did not end my clinging to pleasure. They did not end my craving, my aversion. None of it worked. Temporary avoidance techniques was what I was taught. He said, but when I discovered mindfulness of being with what's happening without judging it as good or bad, and without avoiding the mind, but turning towards the mind in its own natural state of impermanent thoughts and emotions. And I said, this was really the key and the turning point. He said, but there was something in me where I knew it had to be possible. I hoped it was possible. Hope. Hope is interesting, right? You have hope. Sometimes hope is such a good thing because it means like it's like hope and faith are kind of a little bit connected sometimes the way we're saying I have hope. But sometimes when we use this term hope, it's expectation. I hope it's like this and not like that. I hope it's fucking pleasant and not unpleasant is basically often how we're using the term hope. Not I have hope for freedom in the midst of pain. In the midst of boringness, neutrality. In the midst of impermanent pleasure. So he said I had faith. He said, but faith wasn't enough. And how much faith do you have? 1 to 10, just in your mind. Judge yourself right now. 1 to 10, how much confidence, how much faith, how much hope do you have? And it doesn't have to be for full enlightenment, but just that, like, this shit will work for you. That you could suffer less. Maybe that you could get fully liberated. Maybe you have that kind of confidence. But I'm not asking for that. But, like, how bought in, how much confidence do you have? And I'm not talking about in anything other than the possibility of your own transformation through your own efforts. It doesn't even have to be Buddhist, you know, like whatever makes sense to you. He said, from that, then I was willing to put in the work, do the work, the effort. Then I worked really hard. And I dedicated my whole life's energy to training my mind, to being mindful in all of my activities, to renouncing negative karma-producing activities. I wanted freedom from more than I wanted freedom to. Sometimes I want the freedom to, you know, do what I want, and that's going to cause some harm to myself and others, but that's fucking America. I am free to harm. Myself in all kinds of ways. Free to harm myself in all kinds of ways. This is liberty. So we can look at how much confidence we have, and then we can look at how hard are we working. To what extent are we willing to, do we want freedom from more than freedom to, and say, I'm going to practice some renunciation. A big part of the path is renunciation. There's all of the discipline that we add to our lives. We say, I'm going to meditate. I'm going to show up and be part of community. I'm going to study some. I'm going to participate in, I'm going to be on the path. But then there's all of the precepts, the renunciation. I want to be mindful, so I'm not going to put into my body substances that block mindfulness. I want to be honest. I'm going to stop lying and stealing and manipulating and exaggerating, and I want to live free in the midst of reality without manipulating my experience all of the time. And it's so easy in this world, in this culture, to manipulate our experience all of the time. Oh, I don't like the way this feels. I'm going to avoid it. I'm going to suppress it. I'm going to replace it with an intoxicant, with a television show, something. So the path becomes our whole life, and freedom becomes, when it becomes the priority, if it's really what we want, and we have our understanding that freedom includes pain. Maybe that's part of the equation, is that, do I want freedom enough to be in a lot of pain sometimes? What do I want more, pleasure or freedom? And if we're honest with ourselves, we usually choose pleasure, right? Most of the time you say, yeah, fuck that freedom shit. I want pleasure. I want to not feel this pain. How do I get out of it? How do I avoid it? How do I suppress it? How do I ignore it? How do I replace it? But the only way to real freedom is turning towards the pain. Now, of course, I have to acknowledge that we're not talking about like a sadistic lifestyle or masochistic. Yeah, masochistic. Maybe both. We're not talking about like, yeah, pain is good. We're just talking about that pain is unavoidable. It's impossible to avoid. There's some of it, right? There's the unavoidable aspects of life that are unpleasant. It's just no matter what. And I love that the Buddha was honest about this. And I think that most traditions are not honest about this. And they promise everlasting bliss. And it sells way better. And even Buddhism, as soon, you know, a lot of the traditions, and there's all of these teachings and things that get thrown into Buddhism that say like, oh yeah, it's going to be pleasant all of the time. But when you look at the early teachings, that's not what is in the earliest Buddhist teachings. He was quite honest about like, no, the pain continues. If you have a physical body, the end of pain only comes when you no longer take rebirth. If you have a nervous system, you have pain. If you have a mind, you have unpleasant thoughts habitually. If you take them personal, you suffer. Period. If you have unpleasant thoughts and you don't take them personal, no suffering. When you know that you're not your mind, and that they're just habit formations in the mind, no suffering. No self. No problem. Self, suffering. Self-centeredness, suffering. So we have to, I'm always asking myself, encouraging you to ask yourself this investigation. What do I want more in this moment? Do I really want to be free? Am I actually committed to being awake? Will I turn towards this pain? Or am I going to turn away from it? Am I going to let go of this pleasant experience, or am I going to cling to it? And that with mindfulness, it's a choice in every single moment. Am I going to let go and let this arise and pass? Or am I going to cling to it? Am I going to push this away? Am I going to act? Am I going to try to avoid? Am I going to be with it, even though it feels unbearable at times? One of my teachers, Jack Kornfield, said somebody was on retreat and they were having all of these really difficult emotions. And he said, sometimes it's the right thing to do to just turn towards your difficult emotions and say, come kill me. Because that's the sort of message that they're giving us, right? You can't handle this. I'm going to overwhelm you. I'm going to murder you. My fear is going to murder me. My shame is going to drown me. Whatever it is. He said, sometimes it's the right thing. It's a little macho. He said, but sometimes it's the right thing to just say, bring it on. You're just fucking emotion. You can't do shit. Except for make me cry. That's like, you know, you could get me in a fetal position on the ground. That's about it. You can't kill me. Because you're just an impermanent emotion. You can't kill me. You can just create some real unpleasantness that will come through. And when we really wake up to that, and if we turn towards in that way, that's a part of the freedom for sure. Freedom to be with difficult emotions. And then in my experience, is the more I started turning towards my self-hatred and my fear and my shame and all of that stuff, the more they started to decrease. When I spent the first half of my life trying to avoid those unpleasant emotions, they just got bigger and bigger and bigger. And then we come to meditation and start turning towards them, and you start to see, like, oh, they're just emotions. They're just thoughts. They're not even true, most of them. And they start to decrease. Oh, now there's something about the mind, what we call Mara sometimes, that part of the mind that when it realizes that you're not taking the bait anymore, sort of mellows out. It's like, oh, no, she's seen through it. He's seen through it. They've seen through it. And then the afflictive emotions start to lessen. I don't think they go away completely for anyone. They didn't go away for the Buddha. I don't think they go away for anyone completely. It's just part of having a mind. But the good news is that it does decrease, and the positive mind states do increase. And there is more kindness in the mind and more friendliness and more compassion. And the compassion becomes so much more accessible. And a habit to meet pain with compassion rather than the habit of meeting pain with hatred or avoidance. So these are some of my thoughts. What else do I want to say? It's really quite simple, right? Turn towards your pain. Learn to feel it. Stop running from it. You'll never escape. Stop clinging to pleasure. I'm not, like, saying this to you. I'm saying this to me. Like, it's what we're all trying to do. Turn towards your mind. Don't, you know, it's why mindfulness, I think, is just, it's so important. And the third foundation of mindfulness is so important. So many of us have wasted so much time ignoring our minds as our core meditation practice. And even in mindfulness practice, even in Buddhism, people do that, where their whole practice for decades is just paying attention to their breath and ignoring their mind. And then you never break your addiction to the mind. You're always ignoring it. And this third foundation where the Buddha says, turn towards it, see it. See that the thoughts and emotions are impermanent, they're impersonal. Turn towards your mind, develop a wise relationship to your mind. Renunciation of harmful behaviors, and this is all in the category of purifying our karma. Compassion, non-clinging, and karmic purification. Coming to understand that we are fully responsible for our behaviors. We're fully responsible for our reactivity to what happens. Not necessarily for what happens. Let's just, don't turn karma into another way that it's all your fault. I invite you to see karma not as what's happening, but in how you're responding to what's happening. How are you acting? How are you behaving? Rather than assigning karma as, like, well, this is all my fault. It is happening, and our karma is how we act in response to it. Right now, it's like this, and I can make it worse, or I can be free in this moment. It's painful and I can make it worse. It's pleasurable and I can ruin it. That's our karma. And the purification is more and more compassion towards pain. Not only ours, also other people's. More and more non-attachment, which includes generosity and service and compassionate engagement with others in the world.
Mm-hmm.
the last thing that I'll say is my sense is that everybody comes to practice from some personal sense of unhappiness, dissatisfaction, difficulty. Something is motivating us to do something as crazy as sit still and pay attention. Very few people are just like, yeah, everything's amazing in my life. I'm going to meditate. It might happen. I mean, it might happen for some people, but I don't know any of them. Usually there's like some stressors, there's some suffering, like we all have it, that motivates us, and it's usually personal. Maybe some people are like, well, I feel okay inside, but I just don't know what to do in this world where there's so much racism and so much confusion and oppression and corruption, ignorance, and that external forces motivate us to practice. But at some point on that continuum from, we'll call it bondage to suffering, to freedom to suffering, at some point when you start to experience some personal freedom, it makes sense to, it's a kind of a natural shift from I'm here for my suffering to a bit more of an altruistic, I'm here to not just end my suffering, but to help alleviate suffering on this planet. As the Buddha himself did, he didn't retire after enlightenment. He didn't say, like, well, cool, I'm free. I'm going to just chill and enjoy my freedom. He said, I'm now going to work against this racist society that I live in and these delusional religious norms that are confusing people. I'm going to work hard, actually, to create a positive change and to empower women in a way that they're not empowered in this society, and to end some of the systematic structural racism of the caste system. He said, I'm going to work for a positive change as the outcome, this altruistic engagement with the world. Not just like, I'm free. But we can all be free, and if I can do it, anybody can do it, and let's help each other. And not in the, my friend Molly came in joking about this interaction that we had recently about whether we believe it's possible to have world peace. And I think I called her a hippie or something. She called herself a hippie, maybe. You know, and saying that my sense is that the Buddha didn't think we could have world peace. That, you know, last week, some of you heard last week, samsara, not a realm of peace. Samsara, this world, a realm of suffering and confusion and ignorance. But the Buddha the acceptance of this world being filled with confusion wasn't complacency. It was an activated an action of saying, like, yes, this world is filled with ignorance. Let's work against it. Let's try to create a positive change. Let's keep working for it, even though maybe it's not going to work. Even though probably people are going to continue to be super ignorant in general. But let's, from the inside, let's try to end all of our internal ignorance. And from the outside, let's try to end some of the ignorance and oppression that's taking place on this planet. Let's try. These are some of my thoughts. I'd like to spend the last few minutes with some dialogue. Your thoughts, questions, comments. Does it make sense? What parts of it don't make sense?
Please. I know. I'm curious as to how we can help others reduce their suffering when they're not in a place to receive the help. Whether they're physically sick with an illness or a disease, and it's not something that is temporary, like it's something that's permanent and constantly there.
Mm-hmm.
And feeling like the cup of compassion and understanding is just dry,
mm-hmm.
because you're exhausted by seeing all the ongoing suffering and all the resistance to trying to do something to alleviate it.
I think that the first piece is self-care. Is not letting our cup go so dry by developing that equanimity practice, which is looking at this world and looking at our loved ones and people who are suffering and understanding that they have their own karma and that our wishes for them can never change their suffering. No matter how much we love someone, we cannot make them have compassion for their pain. When it's the internal cause of suffering, we are powerless over other people's internal relationship to their sensations and emotions and mind. The most influence that I think we have is by really embodying it ourselves. And the more that you have compassion for your pain, and the more you have non-attachment and joy in the face of the difficulties that they're having, the more they'll be like, wow, maybe this is fucking possible. When you're embodying it, the Dharma, then, you know, that where I was talking about faith earlier. When we reflect on what gives us faith, some of you maybe have it from inside. Like even, you know, you're asking the question, like, what gives you confidence that you can suffer less, that you can have compassion, that you can... And you can reflect on, for me, it always came from outside of me. It was like I met, you know, people that were doing it, that inspired me to do it. I was like, oh, if they can do it, maybe I can do it. I didn't have what the Buddha had, that internal, like, I know freedom's possible. I was on the way on the other side. I was like, nope, suffering is just the way it is forever. And then I saw people in recovery that weren't suffering so much. I was like, what are you, you're not strung out and you're not suffering? What are you doing? And I started meditating, and my father was, you know, I saw my dad. I was like, the dude was pretty happy. You're meditating. Oh, shit, I better try that. From the outside, inspired by others, that, you know, in recovery they say, who's carrying the message to us. But in the Dharma, it's the same thing. Who inspires us to say, if they can do it, maybe I can do it. And so that's a big piece. Us doing the work ourselves. Maybe it's the, you know, the Buddha did his work, and here we are 2,600 years later still talking about the dude. And you see the Dalai Lama, and you're like, wow, that guy looks fucking happy. I want to be happy like the Dalai Lama. See Thich Nhat Hanh walking super slow, and you're like, that's cool, I want to walk super slow. People, we inspire each other. We influence each other. We're connected in that way, especially to our loved ones. But not in a magical way. But I feel like there's that core, you know, it's an overused analogy, but like on the airplane. They say, when you're going down, make sure to put on your mask first before tending to your children. How fucking counterintuitive is that? It makes sense when we think about it, of like, oh no, like if the air pressure is, if I pass out, both of us are fucked. So I better put mine on first so that I can make sure to get it on my kid. But of course, like there's that intuition, like, no, I'm going to help you first. You're my child or, you know, my loved one or whatever it is. I'm going to help you first at my own expense. But then I'm going to be depleted of oxygen and neither of us are going to get the help we need. So there is that importance. Like the Buddha, he wasn't of service to anybody for those 7 years. 7 years doing his own work. Selfish Buddha. Just fucking sitting around meditating for 7 years while the world was on fire. But he did that, and then he spent 40 years creating, you know, like really changing the world in some serious ways. Like, what a shift happened in his culture and on this planet from him dedicating his life to his work. With a lineage that, you know, like somehow got to us thousands of years later, because he did hit, because he put on his mask first and then was able to share it in a way that was inspiring, that made sense, where we can hear the Four Noble Truths and be like, yeah, this shit makes sense. I'm going to do that. I'm going to try to become compassionate. I'm going to try to not cling. I'm going to break my addiction to my mind. I want that. So the equanimity practice in particular, look at your loved one who's suffering and remember that they have their own karma in relationship to their pain, that you cannot change it. You have your own karma in relationship to your pain. You can change it. And changing yours may inspire them or others to do their work as well. Other thoughts, please? Front row here.
My toughest challenge for many years has been to realize the separation between my mind and myself, especially because of the struggles I've had with depression and anxiety. I think on an existentialist level, I've had a very difficult time making that separation. And also, aside from that, going forward, I felt that if I make that separation, there's that duality that can create issues in different ways, in terms of taking responsibility, in other psychological ways. How did the Buddha approach that separation? Or how do you approach that?
Of course I don't know the answer to how, but the first thing, and you hear me talk about this a lot because I love the teaching, that the Buddha referred to those negative aspects of his own mind as Mara. And he created a duality, an internal duality, and said that none of this is self, but some of this not self is very confused, bad advice giving Mara. Really wants me to suffer. And he created, you know, and so he related to it. He created that internal dialogue where he said, you know, I see you, Mara, to his own mind. And it didn't create any, it actually was freedom. It wasn't dangerous to create that duality between the wise thoughts. He talks about the ability to abandon the negative thoughts or identification with them and to cultivate the positive, the development of. And if you're going to be identified with anything, be identified with the love and the kindness and the generosity and those wholesome thoughts and not the unwholesome thoughts. And my experience has been like that too. There was a shift that happened for me at some point, I don't know when, from taking everything very personal to like, my mind, I'm suffering, I'm afraid. And then somehow in the meditation, some years in, started to shift to a less personal of like, the mind. Rather than my mind, the mind is confused. There's fear here. Rather than I am afraid, that shift that happens in mindfulness, third foundation of turning towards our mind and knowing what's happening, and seeing like, oh, this is just fear. And it used to be, I am terrified. And now I can just see, oh, there's like, terror is present in my mind, or in the mind. But there's a shift that happens where there's some space around it. for me, it was some years into practice that that happened. And I don't live in that place all of the time. Sometimes I'm like, I'm afraid or I'm angry. But often it's more like a relationship to anger arising or fear arising or lust arising or whatever it is. And meditation will give us that experience. Or even to like depression. Oh, there's depression present. Without I am depressed. But that's it's heavy, it's foggy, it's, you know, an ability to be with those states and to know them rather than to be them is something that comes in. And I know you've been practicing for some time, and I would imagine that you've had some shift, some separation from it. But maybe the most important thing is that I believe it's safe, and that part of your mind that says there could be some problems with this duality of not taking it all personal, that might be Mara itself. Saying, like, don't not take it personal. It might not be safe if you don't take it personal. But that might be that part of the mind that is invested in us staying stuck. And that we should question that.
You're talking about how the Buddha, the stuff that was going on in society when he was alive, and like, fucked up then too, you know.
Yeah.
Like, do you think it's any harder to find freedom today, you know, or is it just harder?
I don't know. It's pretty popular for in each generation for people to be like, "Well, it's way harder now." You know. So, there is something. You know, it does feel like with technology and the access to pleasant producing experiences that we have, that you know, our progress and our technology has often been used. I mean, it's been used in so many wonderful ways in medicine, and I mean, there's been so many great uses of technology and progress and. So I don't know. I don't know the answer. I'm sure that there's a lot of people here that have a lot of opinions about that. And I often hear people say, like, oh no, it's way harder now, and people, like, they have too much access, and they could be right, but...
Well, I wonder if it's like, you know, like, I guess, right, it's one person's pain is their own pain, my pain is my pain, it's relative, right? I mean, it's kind of like,
yeah. What I will... say, and it might be idealistic, is that I think that freedom is still possible. I think that it's possible in the midst of all of this that's happening in this world. I mean, it's possible. And I've, you know, directly, and each one of us has directly experienced somewhere on that continuum of, I was stuck and I'm less stuck. I'm not completely free, but I'm so much less stuck. Please.
I'm wondering whether some of this has to do with age. When I was younger, I used to marvel at some of these old women that just didn't give a fuck about anything. You know, and I'd say, I wish I could be like that. How do they do this? And I find that as I've gotten older, and I don't have the discipline to do a practice. I basically follow, my heart says go here, and that's what I listen to. But I don't have a practice. But I found that in recent years, I don't care. I mean, I would like people to like me, yeah, more than dislike me. But it doesn't really matter. And I see sometimes, I remember some woman thought I was a con man about something. And I thought, you know, all I need to know is where I am coming from. I see my job is to show up with love and have no hidden agenda. That's my job. And so I've achieved a lot of freedom with that. But I think a lot of this has to do with just the aging process. You know,
sure.
I've gone through therapies, but I've seen people older that's never done any therapy.
Yeah.
But somehow something happens with the aging process. I just want to throw that out.
That's there. Freedom from testosterone.
Not so. Not so.
But you know what I mean. Not just testosterone, but it is. Like, so much of our suffering is created biologically, and some of those, as they mellow out, there's less self-centeredness, there's less craving, there's less maybe fear. Not for everyone. Last thought.
If I understand, the Buddha's livelihood came from his sangha, his shelter, his living. Is this where dana came from?
Yeah, originally, thank you for the setup. he's a shill. Originally, the term dana was like the just the food offerings. It was because, you know, the Buddha said, we're going to give up all material things, we're going to be celibate, we're going to live only on that which is freely offered to us in this day. And so the dana was feeding the Buddha or the Buddhists, the followers, in that day. And he even made a rule that you couldn't keep any food overnight. So you had to interact with people every single day for your daily meal, for your daily sustenance. No refrigerator, no storage. You know, no leftover, no doggy bag. And it was a practice. It was a disciplined practice of saying, I'm going to make myself available, and I'm going to beg, and I'm going to ask for donations every single day, and I'm not going to save any of it. Partially also so that I can interact with other people and make myself and my followers interact in the relational connection. I'm going to offer you teachings, and I'm going to dedicate my life to the practice, and you have the opportunity to feed me if you care to. And so dana originally was, there was no monetary donation, it was just who's going to offer the meal. And then there were some wealthy merchants that came along and said, well, we're happy to offer you guys food every day, we love what you're doing, we're so inspired, how about if we give you this field? And you can live there rather than living in the forest. How about if we build you a few structures? How about a meditation center? You know, like, and so then it became a thing of actually giving to kind of create housing and some structures, some of the early monasteries, because it wasn't just food. And the Buddha allowed it. He said, yeah, no, totally, it's good karma to be generous, the dana offering. And it's good, you know, we want to practice, we want to dedicate our life to practice. So this term dana that he's asking about, we translate often as generosity. It means this sort of offering to the Sangha, offering to the teachers, offering to the Buddha originally.
So just a quick question. Does a Dharma teacher should ever fly first class?
Always they should. Is it a serious question?
Because I don't know of any Dharma teacher in our community who lives that way.
First class?
Someone who his livelihood is not dependent from Sangha.
Uh-huh.
They have a very comfortable life.
So you mean, are you saying you don't know of any teachers that have a comfortable life?
No.
Or that don't?
Who live entirely
on dana.
On dana.
Right. Well, very few teachers are able to, actually. There's actually a big problem here, and I know we're going over. There's a big problem in American Buddhism. Many of the teachers who are now old, aging, and need to retire, have been living on dana, on the donations of their students, for the last 40 years. And they go from retreat to retreat and class to class, and they get enough to get by every year, and they're living in that kind of almost monastic, but as a householder thing. But they don't have retirement funds, because they've just been living on the donations that have been coming to them, And so there's kind of two class of Dharma teachers. There's a handful of them that somehow like had some successful, maybe some major donors that gave them some money, or some, or they maybe came from money, or they had some investments. There's a handful of the kind of senior Dharma teachers that like were already wealthy, and they said, well, I'm already wealthy, and so I'm going to dedicate my life to practicing and teaching. And then there's this whole other crew of teachers who don't have any money, and they need to retire soon, but nobody has offered them retirement dana. And, you know, if they don't keep teaching, they can't actually keep paying their rent. And so that's happening. But so the spectrum of wealth in the kind of teaching community, there's a handful of teachers that for sure fly first class all of the time because they have the money and they want to be comfortable. And most of that money is not coming from the Sangha. It's money that they already have. So there's a spectrum, for sure. Yeah. I have a lot of thoughts about that. Actually, maybe I'll give a talk on that next week. So we can end there with a short recap, which is that freedom's possible and it's your choice. And I hope it's the choice that you make.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.